of the spot, just constantly drinking those double shots. Greatest thing beneath the sun is having fun.
Welcome back. That's Memphis Slim, the great American blues pianist, singer, composer, born on this day in Memphis, Tennessee in 1950. And we're singing that song, appropriate for what we just heard, Having Fun. So speaking of having fun, we're going to talk about something that's not quite fun, but is a very real issue facing the Middle East and people in the Middle East that we've been covering very intensely with folks from Iraq and other places, which is the Islamic State. We are joined here by Dr. Stephen David, who is professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and Dr. Vijay Prashad, who is the George and Martha Kellner Chair of South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, author of many books including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and a columnist for the India magazine, Frontline. And Stephen David and Vijay Prashad, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can email me, you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, but please join us, 410-319-8888. As we saw, the assassination of another American reporter, beheading by Islamic State, and I think that there's been so much written, and we talked about this last time, the air, Tabat Abdullah, who is another scholar from Iraq, who's now in Toronto and was a force against Saddam Hussein and also opposed the American invasion, said on this program that ISIS was born of the morass that came out of Iraq, and its leadership is Iraqi, and it is spreading into the veins of young people across the planet. And Vijay Prashad, let me ask you first to give us your sense of that.
Well, it's true factually. I experienced this directly in Ramadi and Fallujah last year when, if you took a look at the Islamic State brigades, it's true that many of the young people would not have, known fully the regime of Saddam Hussein because they are, now in their 20s. But just above them, in terms of people who organized the brigades and conducted, the fighting, those were all veterans of the army of Saddam Hussein. Those were many veterans of the Ba'ath Party, all people who had lost their jobs after the United States essentially destroyed the Iraqi state in 2003. And, it's because of these sophisticated, battlefield-hardened commanders that the Islamic State is able to operate at a greater level of sophistication than anything that I've seen, in Afghanistan, where the battlefield kind of command is much more haphazard and much more amateurish than what one is seeing here, where these are not only people highly trained, but some of them had direct experience in the war against Iran.
Stephen David, your take on the same thing.
Yeah, I mostly agree. I mean, clearly, in the wake of the American invasion, the fact that you had an Iraqi government take over that was not embracing in any way or including the Sunni population helped give birth to groups like ISIS who have this sense of horrible disenchantment and alienation from the state. And, of course, having Sunni military officers from Saddam Hussein's military has given them a level of sophistication and skill that a typical terrorist or guerrilla group would not have.
So then there's let me talk about an immediate headline before we open the phones here at 410-319-8888 and talk about what how the West and the rest should respond to this, and this is not an easy kind of fix. But in the article in Times, it talked about, the sad assassination of Stephen Sutloff, the American journalist, and now they're threatening to kill a British journalist as well. There was an article about what happened in Amerli, Iraq, which was a place where Turkoman Shiites held off the Islamic State, even though they had no food and water left. The entire village banded together and actually fought back. and was broken through because of airstrikes by both the Americans and the Iraqi Air Force. And then four brigades, some of whom are Iranian, coming into the city to bolster the city and to liberate it. So what's interesting to me is that the kind of alignments this is causing that one would never think of a few months ago between certain Shiite militias, Iranian militias, the American government and the Iraqi government. So this Stephen David is an interesting twist.
It is. I mean, it really is strange bedfellows. And of course, you know, part of this is you have this vast Sunni Shia civil war spreading across the Middle East that hasn't got the attention it deserves, perhaps because Israel is not at the center of this. But you have the United States indirectly in support of Iran, both of whom are seeking to counter the extreme Sunni groups such as ISIS. America is also indirectly in support of Assad because ISIS is an enemy of Assad, and the extent to which we want to support groups that are trying to unseat Assad makes it very uncomfortable for us. But look, I mean, this is what international politics is about. I mean, if you go back to World War II, the United States and Britain aligned with Stalin to defeat Nazi Germany. And I'm not equating the threats, but sometimes you have strange bedfellows when you have a common adversary.
But one of the things I would ask you, Vijay, about this is, I mean, this the difference there may be that what the Middle East and perhaps the world are facing with IS, the Islamic State, is something that was born out of a Pandora's box that kind of enveloped the world because of the Western-supported dictatorships of the Middle East, the killing of the left and the Arab and parts of the Muslim world. I mean, it's a very complex thing that gave birth to this. It'll be an equally complex thing to deal with it.
Well, you know, the first thing to say is, just to pick up on what Stephen was saying earlier,
sure.
I actually don't think that the campaign in MLE is going to be indicative of what's coming in the future. It's important to recognize that the United States airstrikes have basically been conducted to protect two major U.S. allies. One, the province of Iraqi Kurdistan, which is why the Americans bombed just outside Erbil, and they, in fact, bombed howitzer batteries that the Islamic State had stolen from the base at Mosul, which the Iraqi army had left behind. And the Iraqi army, of course, had received those howitzers from the United States. So one set of bombing was to protect Iraqi Kurdistan. The MLE bombing essentially was to stop the advance of the Islamic State coming down into Baghdad. And, you know, there was, of course, the Badr Brigade, which is supported by the Iranians. But there were also Iranian fighters who then withdrew back to Iran once MLE was taken again. So I just want to say that these are very specific alliances to protect Baghdad and to protect Iraqi Kurdistan. Where the Islamic State actually is much more entrenched, which is in the western stretch of Anbar province, in Ramadi, Fallujah, and then, of course, up in Raqqa, which is the central city in Syria, in north-central Syria, there the United States will not be able to strike. And the reason the United States cannot strike is because there are some very severe contradictions which U.S. policy has not been able to cut through. So when Mr. Obama says we don't have a strategy, what he perhaps indicates is that because Turkey is a NATO ally, and Turkey is unwilling to recognize the Islamic State as a major threat. You know, its newly anointed prime minister refuses to call the Islamic State a terrorist organization. He said it has terrorist indications. And they continue to allow their border to be relatively porous. And at the same time, the principal fighting agents against the Islamic State in that region, in western Anbar and in northern Syria, have been the Kurdish resistance and guerrilla groups, which the Turkish government and the Americans see as a terrorist organization, and that is the Kurdish Workers' Party. So I just want to say that, you know, for much of where the Islamic State is operating, there is no alliance in the offing, And in fact, therefore, they are benefiting greatly from the political vacuum.
So what you just said is, I think, very critical to all these questions that are coming about what America and the West should do. Because that's what I was trying to get to as well with the question I was asking you both, which was the utter complexity of all of this, which I think many people just have these simplistic answers. When you see the editorial that was written by Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham insisting that Barack Obama step up and increase military action against the Islamic State. And so it was interesting because they also say that he exceeds his authority, but then they say it's okay that he needs to do that now, but whatever. But the question is, it's not that simple. I mean, what Western response should be to this? Should there be a Western response? Stephen David, I think this is something America and the West and Britain are going to have to grapple with.
Well, I think there needs to be some American response.
And what does that mean? What form does that take?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand that the principal threat that ISIS presents is not to the United States or to the West. It's the people in the region, especially those who are not of this extreme Sunni inclination. So you're talking about the Kurds. You're talking about the moderate Sunnis. You're talking about the Shia in the south of Iraq. So you have groups who are directly threatened by ISIS. And it's up to the United States and the West to mobilize, support, and equip these groups to fight an enemy who is clearly presenting an existential threat to them.
Vijay?
Well, you know, the issue is that firstly, it's very hard to take Senator John McCain seriously on foreign policy because his knee-jerk reaction to any conflict or any moment of tension is let's bomb there. You know, somehow bombing is going to solve the problem. When we know that when politics are intractable, bombing is not necessarily the best approach. So that's just to say on the side. But linked to that, I think there's a danger in American foreign policy making where, you know, what appears to be at the surface of public discussion is not what to do for the people in Iraq or Syria or indeed Jordan, which is very much threatened by the rise of the Islamic State. But what will salve the conscience of the American public? You know, has the American public felt that it's done enough or something or whatever? I think that's a very trivial way for public discussion to be held, and I hope people are going to rise above that. As far as the question of the region is concerned, and Stephen is right, this directly impacts people in the region. The link to Britain, I mean, David Cameron's speech I found to be highly hyperbolic, you know, and I would hope that in the United States people don't take his lead. You know, the belief that the Islamic State is going to somehow overrun Washington, D.C. is a very, very peculiar fantasy. The direct threat is to people in that region. And I think, yes, aerial strikes have halted the advance of the Islamic State in Iraq against the Kurds, against Baghdad. Yes, it's true that if there is further strikes, they will degrade the Islamic State a little, but they will certainly not be able to vanquish the Islamic State. It can only be vanquished on the ground and not by American boots. I totally agree that boots on the ground are needed, but you don't need Americans to be wearing those boots. The people who are actually fighting them are the Kurdish guerrillas. And the bizarre problem, you know, Mark, is that when you look at the breaking of the siege at Jabal Sinjar, when the Yazidis were trapped there, when the USAID workers first arrived on the helicopter, the people on the mountain who greeted them were not desperate Yazidis, but they were fighters from the Kurdish Workers' Party. Now, the U.S. government cannot admit that. As I said, we see them as a terrorist organization. You have to recognize that 25,000 Yazidis were sprinted out of Jabal Sinjar across the border into Syria, not by American troops, but by Kurdish fighters. And that is where the onus is going to lie. The problem is that because of the contradictory nature of U.S. foreign policy and because of increasing sectarianism in the conflict, I think a lot of care has to be taken not to further alienate the Sunni population, either in Iraq or in Syria. Because the root problem here is to kind of ratchet down the sectarian rhetoric and make sure that other forms of belonging are part of the politics of the region and not simply sectarianism.
And I want to raise a couple of issues, and I might ask if you two have a moment. We might, if we can bleed this maybe into the for 5 minutes or so into the second hour, if you can stay with us, because there's some really important questions I think Vijay has raised, Stephen has raised, I want to kind of pursue. Let's go to the phones first at 410-319-8888. And Ernest in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
First of all, when I think it started with the Gulf War One, when George Herbert Walker Bush invaded Iraq for no reason at all, and then his son George W. invaded Iraq basically just for the oil. They had made plans and cut up the oil and divided the money. Him and his regime, and then they put J. Paul Brenner in charge. He didn't know the area. He didn't speak the language. He didn't know anything about what was going on over there. And he got rid of the Ba'ath Party, which were the teachers, the doctors, the lawyers, the soldiers, and everything. And then when the people rioted, they had nowhere to go. Then we had to fight. But the United States and England and these Western countries have been dreaming of that all ever since it's been over there. And now they have the whole Sunni nation all over the world, Chechens and Pakistani, everybody that's going over there to fight. Man, the United States can go over there and fight. It's going to be some more dead bodies, because after all, we went into Libya, destroyed that country. Saddam Hussein was against the terrorists. We destroyed him, and we allowed Egypt to be destroyed. I mean, the whole thing is about the project of the new American century. These white folks over in the United States that want to destabilize the Middle East, I think, for Israel.
Okay, let's see if we can. We have like 3 minutes left in this particular segment, but I'd like you both to respond to what Ernest said. Let me start with you, Stephen David.
Well, I'm trying to find something that I can agree with or that accords with reality in what he said. Well, first, I mean, when we look at the first intervention, I think the call said it was done for nothing in 1990. Iraq had invaded Kuwait, and the United States was part of a multilateral coalition to move to restore Kuwait's sovereignty. So it wasn't the question of not doing this for no reason at all. But in terms of the broader point that America wants to destabilize the Middle East in order to have access to oil, in fact, I think it's much easier for the United States and the world to have access to oil if the Middle East is stable. Instability and groups like ISIS, if anything, threaten access to oil, which, by the way, is becoming, thankfully, less critical as the United States develops its own oil resources through fracking and other means. So the notion that oil drives everything, that America wants to destabilize the Middle East, and that everything that's bad happens because the United States did something, I think is just nonsense.
We have to take a quick break. We'll come back when we hear what Vijay Prashad has to respond, but also talk about some other key issues here before we go on to our next topic. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen David and Dr. Vijay Prashad. Freddie King, born on this day in 1934, in Gilmore, Texas, one of our great guitarists ever, blues guitar, along with B.B. King and his brother Albert King, three of the greats. We return here to our conversation with Dr. Stephen David, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and Dr. Vijay Prashad, the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and professor of international studies at Trinity College, author of many books, including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, who also writes a column for the Indian magazine Frontline, and you at 410-319-8888. But Vijay, let me pick up where we left off, and then before we close out the conversation. And I just think that sometimes we can create kind of it's a complex situation, but we can kind of create simplistic scenarios about why this is taking place. And I think it's hard just to kind of pinpoint one specific thing.
Well, yes, of course, that is the case. But I mean, after all, that's what conversations are about.
Right.
That, you say a few things and somebody builds on them. I wouldn't be so dismissive of what that gentleman said.
Oh, not at all. I wasn't saying that at all. No, not at all.
Yeah, no.
Right.
But I think Stephen was a little unnecessarily dismissive. I mean, look, part of the reason why people fall to the argument that it's about oil is because I would put the onus to a great extent on our political leaders. Their inability to fully and properly explain to the public what their agenda is, what their what the long-term goals are, how they understand the world is part of the problem. If I were to go back to 1990 when Saddam Hussein walked into Kuwait, and I would say, well, of course, the United States had to act. It had to remove the Iraqi army from Kuwait. Well, a simple-minded person might say, well, when Indonesia walked into East Timor, why didn't the United States act then? Or indeed, when, there are 100 other examples of where, big countries swallow small countries and the action is, minimal. I mean, for instance, right now, when Israel was bombing in Gaza, the United States barely did anything. In fact, the contrary, at the Human Rights Council, they provided the only vote against the rest of the members for an investigation of the war that transpired recently. You had this kind of event take place, 2,000 people killed, most of them civilians. And then at the same time, there are people who most Americans have never heard of, the Yazidis, trapped in a mountain, and suddenly, this self-righteous, paternalist rhetoric, everybody take it easy, America is now coming to save the day. That's essentially what President Obama said. I think for people in the country, it's confusing. And I think unless there's a clear assessment from the political leadership, an open assessment about what they see, how they see the world, what they think is happening, all kinds of narratives will come into the vacuum. So, I'm not going to, argue on behalf of the oil narrative. That's, I think, not really the issue here. I, on the other hand, I wouldn't say let's dismiss somebody's ideas. The reason I say we don't dismiss somebody's ideas is because I think the sheer hypocrisy in the name of humanitarianism, of U.S. policy, I think confuses a great number of people.
Well, I would just like to say
go ahead.
We're really talking about apples and oranges here when we're talking about Gaza and what's going on in the Middle East today and East Timor and such. And the notion that somehow hundreds of countries have lost their sovereignty through outside invasion, I would challenge Vijay.
I didn't say hundreds of countries, Stephen.
Well, that's what I thought I heard you say. As far as I can tell, since the end of World War II, I think South Vietnam is the only country that's been erased from the map, not to be returned. But the Gaza issue, Vijay, as I'm sure you know, is a very complicated issue, which also involves Israel's right to protect itself from thousands of rockets launched from Hamas in civilian areas. And so the notion that somehow this is the same or similar to what's going on with ISIS or groups such as that, I just don't see the comparison.
Vijay?
I'm not clear about Israel's right to defend itself. Israel is an occupying power, and that's how the United Nations sees the situation. And as an occupying power, it places a certain burden on Israel to, follow the various rules of international procedure that occupying powers must follow. At the same time, the Palestinians, as an occupied people, have the right to resist. And obviously, it seems from the way you placed it that our narratives are not going to be the same about what happened in Israel. This is precisely why it's confusing for people who may see, for instance, not so much of a distinction between the question of Gaza and the question of minorities in northern Iraq and wonder about U.S. foreign policy. And in the same way, I actually don't know how it's an apple and an orange to compare the Indonesian invasion of East Timor and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Those were both separate entities that were swallowed up by a large neighbor. And in the case of East Timor, the United States essentially winked and might even have given the green light if you accept some narratives. Whereas in the case of Kuwait, there was a great deal of, you know, fury about the question of human rights being violated. So I'm just saying that from the point of view of a lot of people, because the political class seems reticent to provide a clear-headed narrative about the values of its foreign policy, it's very confusing. And I suspect that a number of conspiratorial narratives fill the breach when the political class itself is quite hypocritical about its values.
Well, I certainly agree things are confusing. But as far as I know, East Timor was never a sovereign, recognized, independent state the way Kuwait is. And that's not to justify everything America did with East Timor. But getting back to Gaza, Israel ended its occupation of Gaza in 2005. The so-called siege or blockade only occurred after Hamas took power in 2007 and started launching rockets against Israel.
Well, anyway, just to be clear about the history, the blockade started when Hamas took power before the rockets took place.
That's not clear.
Clear by the Brussels Convention 1899 that just by withdrawing your armed force, you don't end your occupation. I mean, to end the occupation of Hamas would be to deliver its sovereignty. And it has not been delivered sovereignty. There has indeed been a withdrawal of Israeli military force in 2005, but that does not mean that the occupation has ended. That's the basic principles in 1899 Brussels.
Well, this just reminds me that when everyone talks about any dispute, somehow it always gets back to Israel and its responsibility for what is happening.
Let's talk about U.S. foreign policy. I'm perfectly happy to remain there.
Okay.
We do have to take a break, but I think that our caller who called in, Ernest, kind of took us in that direction about Israel. But I think that it does beg questions. I think that we would like to invite you both to come back in the next week to kind of really continue this for a longer discussion than just 25 minutes, because I think it's really a critical and to deal with the reality of facts around what you just challenged with me, Stephen, and I can accept that. And I think people have to wrestle with what the Western response needs to be with Islamic State. I think Vijay laid out very clearly in this conversation about the complexity of what's going on in that area and who's not going to be involved. The issue of Turkey, which really hasn't been talked about very much on many programs in this country. And I think those are all very critical things that we have to come back to, as well as the question of Gaza and Israel, I think, and Palestine and Israel, let me just say. And there have been a lot of articles written in Israeli press and at the moment about the one state. But maybe we've gone beyond the time for a two-state solution. So I think there's a lot of things for us to explore. But unfortunately, I do have to take a break here. But this was a great conversation. We both brought a great deal to our airwaves. Dr. Vijay Prasad, it's great to have you on. We've been looking forward to having you on for a long time. I'm glad you could join us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Stephen David, always a pleasure to have you on, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And we can take a very brief break and come back from this break. We are going to talk about the news story that wasn't, but is, in a different way. Stay with us.
Yes, I was born with the curious.